The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Lacey Feuer. She was born and raised in Ireland and has nearly three decades of experience working in the financial services sector. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her award-winning, character-driven literary work of historical fiction, Yankeeland. It was inspired by the real-life discovery of hundreds of letters between her grandmother in Ireland and her great-aunt who emigrated to America, revealing family secrets from a century ago. Welcome to the Book Show, Lacey.
Thank you so much, Hannah. I am delighted to be on, and I love your show. I particularly loved the one with Gilly Cooper because I am a big fan of Gilly Cooper.
Oh, bless you. That's so nice. It was
wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. And my goodness, how amazing must this have been for you to discover all these letters? Tell me about how and when that happened.
So I was travelling back from a gap year, as a lot of Irish people do tend to travel around the world. And I happened to be visiting relatives in Boston. And I was literally handed two mailbags of the contents of my grandaunt's estate in California. They had lived in California. And then when they had passed away, they had no family. And it was passed on to a relative to go and sort of clear out their estate. So I literally sat on the floor of the brownstone from like 8 a.m. that morning to 8 p.m. that night. I had to be dragged away because as I started to uncover the depth of the secrets in these mailbags, I think it'll stay with me forever, forever.
Gosh, amazing. Can you share the kind of secrets that you're talking about without giving too much away from the book?
So, yes, yeah, I'd be delighted to. So the inspiration for the story, the main bulk of the letters, so there was hundreds of letters among other various postcards, memorabilia, but there was hundreds of letters. And the letters were written between two of the main characters. So Molly, who was at home in Ireland, and Bridget, who had emigrated to America. And what transpired, as I started to go through the letters, I started to see over the years the tone change. I started to see that Molly was no longer signing off her letters to Bridget in America as fond cousin Molly. And I started to go back and forth and back and forth. And what I realised was that Molly in Ireland had no awareness as to how Bridget's life had played out for her in America. And then what I also realised was Molly was obviously withholding, which was very common in those days with secrets. Molly was withholding the truth of what was happening in Ireland to Bridget. So for me in 1993, sort of 20, 30 years after these people had passed away, I was sitting there trying to come to terms with the depth that these people had lived their lives and the truth of their existence was never known in their lifetime.
Gosh.
So that was really, really powerful for me.
Yeah. So when, what kind of time period are we talking? When were these letters written to each other?
So the contents of the bag probably really started from around 1908. So that's when Bridget emigrated. She was 21 years of age. She had just gotten married and she had emigrated to America. So the story is very much sort of early 1900s Ireland and then 1908 they emigrate. So the letters, the bulk of the letters were from sort of 1908 to probably about late 1920s because as Bridget's life started to take a turn, Molly became a little bit embittered in Ireland and had this view that Bridget had gone off, was living her dream, didn't care about anyone in Ireland anymore, when really it was quite different in reality. Bridget's life didn't turn out with glitz and glamour as she had hoped. So the bulk of the letters were between probably 1908, but there was even like just fantastic little things. There was a letter from the parish priest in their village in Wexford to Ellis Island to attest to their character, to let them into America, you know, back in those days. It was just those fantastic items, absolutely fantastic.
Gosh, amazing. And how did you, were they dated? How did you begin to put them together?
Yeah, all beautifully dated. I have some of them framed here. I got them preserved, special glass and all of this framed behind me. They were all dated. Yeah. And the most fascinating aspect for me, and it still is to today, every now and again I'll pull them out to read them, how they wrote was exactly the way I would think today in 2025, you know, 2025, Their thought process, how they spoke, the little jokes they had, the exclamation marks, it was really no different to how I would think today. And I found that really, really interesting because we sometimes have a view of how people behaved historically. And what's particularly interesting, Hannah, is there is very little in history. Most of the voices are men. They're male. Yeah. So most of the writings, the books, the journals, journalism, everything was all from a male perspective. So to actually have an insight into how women thought and how they were perceived and how they went about their day and how they lived their life, that I now know is really rare.
Yeah.
Really rare.
How special and how unbelievable, as you say, that you couldn't necessarily tell that they were written all that time ago. That's amazing. You would expect the language and the things that they talked about to be, well, old fashioned.
Yeah, and not at all. So there was another little line in the letters where, so in Ireland, it was very, very popular in the early 1900s to have the religious missions come to your village, and they might come once a year or once every 2 years if you were lucky enough. And it was a period of deep reflection and prayer, and they would come and they would sort of check out who's the village drunk, who's the philanderer, and, you know, it'd be literally fire and brimstone. And Molly writes in one of her letters to Bridget, she's lamenting at the fact that, you know, you got away, we both had this dream, you're over there having a wonderful time and I'm stuck here in the village. And she says in the letter, and the only thing I have to look forward to is the local mission is here at present, and a big exclamation mark. Like, that's just wonderful. Whereas I would have thought that was blasphemy. You know, I would have thought, Oh my goodness, she'd be burned to the stake in 1920 Ireland.
Amazing. So was Molly jealous of Bridget, do you think?
Yes. So Molly was a beautiful character. And would you believe her daughter only died a couple of months ago? Her daughter lived to the age of 108. 108. Smoked and had a whiskey every day of her life until she was 95 and went into a home.
Wonderful.
So Molly was a beautiful person, a very gentle person. She had decided to stay in Ireland, married a doctor like her father, stayed in the family home. But it was really evident in her letters that the two girls had grown up side by side. They'd lived next door to each other and they both had the very, very same dream. They both were a little bit sort of renegades. They had great jokes between them. They both wanted to go and live this life. So they owned Bridget's family owned a shop, and they would have had access to magazines and the Ladies' Home Journal. And so they would have had a flavour of what life was like outside of their village. So in the early letters, Molly is giving her all the news of the village, who sold a farm, who got married, who died, you know, all of this sort of stuff. But then as time goes on and the letters from Bridget are more sporadic, but there is a reason for that, Molly starts to become less, you can just feel the love slip away in the letters, and they're no longer signed Fond Cousin Molly. There's no longer pages of her writing. It's more very perfunctory, you know, sort of facts about what might be happening. But a wonderful insight to what went on in the village. And there was a village drunk, Tomsey Burke, and he was, you know, always up to his shenanigans. And Molly would write to Bridget about this, and I could just picture them giggling as they would have as children. So, yeah, it was just a fascinating insight into their lives, Hannah.
Yeah. So did it seem as if their relationship sort of petered out as the years went on then?
Absolutely. And that was the single saddest factor for me. I remember with my head in my hands going, no, because I could see how Bridget had been trying to reach out to Molly, and it was just, this is all a big part of the story. And so Bridget lived her life thinking Molly didn't care, and Molly lived her life thinking Bridget just completely abandoned me. You know, she found her dream and found her, and that, to think that they lived their life, Hannah, and to never know the truth of their existence, it is just phenomenal to me that that could happen, because it wouldn't happen nowadays with all our social media and connectivity.
Yeah.
Like, even when I found the letters in 1993, if you think about it, we didn't have access to all that we have now. So even my research, that's, people ask me, why did it take me so long? It was really only in later years we started to get access to archival records and internet and Google. And so it was very different in early 1900s Ireland, particularly.
Yeah. Yeah, there's kind of no excuse to not keep in touch with people these days. You know, the excuse that everyone has is busy, too busy, too busy. But it's so easy. Obviously, it would be lovely to receive a letter, but it's so easy to send a WhatsApp or a little message on Messenger, on Facebook, or just say, hi, thinking about you, hope you're well. Really, really easy to do. Yeah. So, yeah, there's really no excuse.
Well, one thing I do now as a result of this, I always write handwritten letters.
Oh, do you? Always. How lovely.
Yeah, I do. And when I sent my book out to radio shows and different people in Ireland, I always put a handwritten letter with it. And the reception was phenomenal. It made me realise how rare it is. I just think it's such a beautiful way. I think there's so much emotion in a handwritten letter. You're connecting with the pen and with the paper. I use a fountain pen. Now, I am a lover of history. If I could go back to the 1920s, I would happily live in that period. Happily.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Jilly Cooper, because she sent me a handwritten letter to thank me for interviewing her.
Oh, well, I smiled because I remember hiding under the covers reading Rivals when it came out. Rupert Campbell Black was my hero. And I agree with Jilly. The actors aren't handsome enough in the film or the TV adaptation of it. Oh, she's brilliant. Isn't she so full of fun?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, amazing.
It was a brilliant interview. Yeah, I loved it.
Oh, thank you. She needs to live forever, doesn't she?
Oh, I couldn't believe she was 81. Am I correct? Did she say 81?
Yeah, it was a good few years ago I interviewed her. So, yeah.
It was when her last book came out. Yeah, she's doing one on football now, she said. I couldn't see a date as to when it was.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
no, it was a good 5-6 years ago at least. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. There was another lovely little piece in the book, in my story in the bags, and I didn't actually make the connection for a long time, but... Bridget had known Marilyn Monroe's mother, Gladys Pearl Baker, in her lifetime.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, and I reveal how they knew each other in the book, but in the bags there were little picture postcards of Marilyn, and there was quite a few of them. And Bridget had come from a very affluent background. They were rather posh, which was unusual for immigrants. That was one thing my American publishers loved, because they said, Emery, normally immigration stories are destitution and poverty. But Bridget had travelled first class to America, so she wasn't escaping poverty in Ireland. She was following her dream. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, surely, you know, Marilyn Monroe was a Hollywood star. She might have maybe looked down on that type of behaviour coming from very Catholic Ireland. But she actually had a relationship with Marilyn's mother. As I later discovered, I found that they were very connected to each other, which was just wonderful. Another wonderful term that I discovered in my research.
Yeah, amazing. And another part of the book, you talk about mental health and the kind of treatment that your great aunt had in America. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so the novel does highlight, Hannah, a lot about systemic oppression and patriarchal control and medical injustices. So it's quite timely when we consider, you know, where I suppose the female theme is at the moment, and the rise in toxic masculinity. Now, I will say my male characters in the book have received wonderful, I've received wonderful feedback, because outside of the medical characters, the male characters were really wonderful people, very kind. They were very good to the female characters. However, they were of their time. And that's really important, because in those days, people would have looked to the church, they would have looked to the leaders in society, the doctors. All of these people were who they went to for their advice. So Bridget's husband, Bridget's brother, these are the key characters in the story, would have made their decisions around that. So it is very much, I am very passionate about mental health. So there, it does run through this, through Yankee land, and it's very much an intergenerational story of tracing back mental health through the generations and how it can play out in future or current generations. And it does have quite a deep theme. One of the best reviews I got was, it's not a breezy read. And I loved that. I
thrilled. Nice. Thrilled. You didn't want to write a breezy read.
Absolutely not. No. I desperately wanted to be Maeve Binchy. Desperately. Or Jimmy Cooper for the romance. But no, it isn't that. Not this one. My next one might be.
And I have to ask you about money. Where the money came from that they were able to fly first class?
Yeah, so they were very wealthy Irish, very established, very wealthy Irish family. And this really heightened for me the extent of Bridget's passion and dream to chase the glitz and glamour of America, because she would have had any amount of suitable husbands, the length and breadth of the county. They were very well established business people. They were very close to, there was a family called the Doynes. So the book is 95% fact. And obviously it has to be a work of historical fiction because I don't know every detail, but it is based on a true story. So they were quite close to this Anglo-Irish family, the Doynes, who were supposedly related to the royal family. That's all true. And they lived in this beautiful, magnificent Gothic period house close to Wexford, close to where Bridget lived. So Bridget, and there was an American wife, which was very typical in those days, had been brought over with her money, with her heiress, her millionaire dollars to do up the place. And Bridget would have, because they would have delivered the telegrams. And my father in his day used to deliver the telegrams to the same house in the 1940s Ireland. So all of this I know from fact and from memory of my father talking about it. So, so they did come from money and they travelled first class. I have all the details of the itinerary, there are copies of their tickets, all of that information, which would have been incredible in 1908 Ireland to travel first class. And what was wonderful as well, Hannah, when you got to America on the ship, you didn't have to dock at Ellis Island. So she didn't even need the letter from the parish priest, because if you were first class, you stopped before Ellis Island and you were allowed to disembark without any checks, any immigration, nothing. So it was really, the sense of privilege was incredible.
Gosh, how fascinating. And you obviously really loved putting this book together. It must have been such fun.
It was. People talk about, you know, the flow state. So when I left school in the 90s, I had always wanted to go into writing, do a BA in English. And anyway, the opportunities weren't what they are today. And I ended up in finance, and long career in finance, always kept up my creativity, writing short stories and all of that. So I had always wanted to write this story, and I just committed to it full time. And I'm so thrilled. And now I'm embarking on an MA in creative writing.
Oh, well done you.
Yeah, I'm thrilled, and I'm going to commit to this, and I'm working on my next novel. And so it's been an incredible experience. I can't believe I get to experience this in my lifetime, but I'm sure you're the same with the work that you do. It's very creative, and you have to love it, I think. You have to love it.
Yeah, lovely. Well, if people want to get a copy of Yankee Land, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Lacey Feuer, who we've been chatting with today. Lacey, one last question. Why is it called Yankee Land? Is that how Bridget referred to it, or...?
Yes, great question. I can't believe I forgot to say that. So, yes, great question. In their letters, they call America Yankee Land. In all the letters, it's they never mention America. They actually just call it Yankee Land. Yeah, wow. So that it's never going to be any other name but Yankee Land for me.
Love that. Well, it's been lovely chatting with you, Lacey. Thank you so much for joining us. And I wish you all the luck in the world with novel number 2. Get in touch when it comes out.
I will, Hannah. Thank you so much. I loved chatting with you today. Thank you so much.
Talk Radio Europe.
Your voice in Spain.